Mrs. Pruitt, Mr. Stroud.
Good afternoon. This case involving several small wastewater treatment plants in northwest Louisiana potentially has far-reaching implications. It's not easy to start off a case by asking you to depart from the ruling of two of your sister courts, the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, but that is the issue that I would like to start with because I think it is a pure issue of law and it has far-reaching implications, and that is whether the trial court erred when it gave an instruction on the responsive verdict that is applicable for each of the counts using the definition of ordinary negligence instead of criminal negligence. The Clean Water Act, unquestionably, and both sides agree, penalizes both felony conduct and misdemeanor conduct. Both sides agree that for all the charges in this case, the misdemeanor negligence provision was a responsive verdict. Where we disagreed was how to define negligence, and the trial court used the civil instruction. And there are two cases that support what the trial court did. The Ninth Circuit's decision, which interestingly I was looking at it, was argued about 14 years ago this week. Hanusik or Hanusak, depending on pronunciation, and the Tenth Circuit's decision in Ortiz. Despite the length of time that the Clean Water Act has been on the books, there are no other circuit decisions addressing the issue and few district court decisions except in dicta. What those two courts did, with due respect, we would urge was erroneous because they looked at the CWA and they said the word negligence is used without a modifier to interpret the plain and ordinary meaning of the word. We'll go to the definition as it's commonly used, and then citing Prosser and other civil law authorities, by civil law I mean civil as opposed to criminal, both the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit said, well, the ordinary meaning of negligence is a simple, reasonable man standard, and therefore that's what we should use. I think that analysis is absolutely correct if it's considered in the context of Prosser or civil liability cases, because the function of civil liability is to assign responsibility for damages and fault, and that is the traditional definition. Three things about a criminal statute, including the CWA, that are different from any civil statute are traditionally criminal statutes, and as this court recognized when it considered the CWA in the Ahmad case, criminal statutes contain a mens rea of some kind, a moral culpability of some level. They're also intended to deter so that they are on the books and someone knows they're on the books, and if they have that culpable mental state, the purpose of the law is to punish that and deter that. And finally, as Justice Thomas noted in his dissent from the denial of certiorari in Hanusak, criminal statutes normally are narrowly defined in terms of the conduct they prescribe to avoid the risk of punishing conduct that is either innocent or, even if not innocent, not traditionally what is thought of as culpable. Because of that, our request and our belief was that the instruction the trial court should have provided on the responsive verdict for each of these counts would be the model penal code proposed instruction for criminal negligence, which is basically differs from the reasonable man standard of civil negligence, in that it calls for a gross deviation from the standard of care.
What is your response to the old maxim that Congress wanted to use gross negligence? It knew how to say it because it had used gross negligence in other provisions in the Clean Water Act.
My response, and that, in fact, is one thing the Ninth and Tenth Circuit relied on, is twofold. First of all, as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in the Burr decision, which we cited in brief, it wasn't involving the Clean Water Act, but another statute that had both civil and criminal sides. It said it is difficult to compare the two because even when modifiers are used on the civil side of a statute, the purpose of that usually is to distinguish what types of damages will be available. For example, gross negligence may trigger punitive damages or so forth. Whereas in a criminal statute with no modifier, the purpose of a criminal statute is still those issues that were discussed. So the fact that it is unadorned, as some of the cases say, does not mean that necessarily they wanted to fall back on a simple negligence standard. The other point I would make, Your Honor, is that if we look at other federal statutes, and there aren't a lot that I've seen or that I'm aware of, but for instance, the government in its brief in, I think it was the O'Keefe case, cited a case about negligence that applied to tugboat captains and pilots, ships. And that statute talked about negligence, and then it said in the list of conduct that it prescribed, said inattention to duty, which is clearly signaling, I think, an ordinary negligence standard. The Clean Air Act has a negligence provision, but it only applies to situations which place a person or which place persons in grave risk of death or bodily harm. So that the ultimate issue does become, without a modifier, what does it mean? And for the reasons we've urged, particularly because there's such a broad range of conduct that results from an ordinary negligence standard. Again, with due respect to the Ninth Circuit's ruling, you had an individual convicted. Basically, the offense occurred while he was at home watching TV or whatever because an independent contractor who was operating a piece of heavy machinery got too close to a pipe and caused a leak, and he was a supervisor, and he went to jail. Is that what Congress truly intended to criminalize? The Ninth and Tenth Circuits have said, yes, we'd urge that you consider that. And also, rather than talking about someone else's conduct, talking about Mr. Pruitt's conduct in this case, this was a case, it seemed to me, that called out for the opportunity for the jury to have a gross negligence standard to consider, because the basic defense for all of the counts was he was operating these wastewater treatment facilities. He was trying to improve them. 100% permit compliance is very difficult. So you had the issue of was he trying hard enough? Was his conduct knowing, as this court talked about in Ahmad, or was it something less than that? And on that issue, I should address something that Judge James actually ruled on in connection with motion for bail pending appeal. We argued that this issue of negligence had not been addressed previously by this circuit and was an important issue, and Judge James agreed, but he said with respect to the felony convictions, he was going to assume that because the jury found the highest level of intent that there could be, that it wouldn't have returned the responsive verdict for negligence, even if he had used the criminal negligence definition. Our respectful disagreement with that is that on something like the record-keeping offenses, where the issue was did Mr. Pruitt do what he needed to do to comply with his permits, or the Levistate's affluent level charge, where the charge was did he truly know over time that he was discharging, was he intentionally discharging in violation of his permits, or was it negligence? On all of those counts, if we could go back into the jury room, what the jury had was three options: guilty of a knowing violation, knowing and intentional; guilty of simple negligence, which is basically all that you need to, the same thing you would need to show if I ran a stop sign on the way home; or not guilty. If the debate had been, or the deliberations, I should say, had been, knowing an intentional violation, gross deviation from the standard of care, or not guilty, I don't think you can say with any certainty that the result would be the same. It might well have been very different, because you could have the deliberations go, well, maybe he should have done a little better with those records, but it wasn't a gross deviation. Or maybe in cases where they found a felony, they would say, well, I think it fits the gross deviation standard better. So that's why on this issue we're asking for basically a remand as to all counts of conviction and a new trial. Now, I realize I skipped over Rule 29, but that was just so that I could get to this issue first, because it permeates every count of conviction. And I'm not clear whether the government disagrees with my last point on that or not, because we argued very specifically in brief that it should apply to every count of conviction, both felony and misdemeanor. Moving from that issue, which I think has the most far-reaching implications in this case, a second issue that is also very important and that could come up again is the scienter or the application of the mens rea for felony offenses. The count 13 conviction for Love Estates was that Mr. Pruitt was knowingly and intentionally violating his permit by over approximately a four-year period on some 42 instances having discharges that exceeded his permit levels. I understand Rule 29. I understand how difficult a challenge that is for a defendant to ordinarily meet. But in this case, we have evidence that, number one, permit violations are not uncommon, including discharges above the level required by the permit. We're talking about some minute measurements of milliliters and so forth. Number two, expert testimony that this facility was exceeding or outperforming the EPA baseline. But number three, and I think this is unique in any case I've encountered, the DEQ, which is the agency that issues the permits, gave Mr. Pruitt his permit, and when they issue these permits, they review the history of the compliance at the facility, and they attach that. And if you look at that, which is in evidence, it shows 38 effluent level violations before the issuance of the permit, including some that he got indicted for. So he ended up being granted a permit by DEQ with knowledge of a long history of permit exceedances and then being charged for some of those exceedances. This is not a technical legal argument that they can't charge him after they've granted him a permit, but on the Jackson v. Virginia standard and on the Rule 29 standard, our contention is you have reasonable doubt in a situation where the administrating agency itself has acknowledged by granting that permit that those types of effluent discharges, even occurring over an extended period, don't represent a knowing and intentional criminal conduct. Otherwise, they surely never would have granted.
Well, now, you know, you got to understand, I mean, the LDEQ is in a situation where if they don't issue him the permit, then who is going to operate these effluent plants? I mean, then what? I mean, he may have been the only volunteer for the task, and they had to have somebody operate these plants. So, I mean, the LDEQ in this situation is over a barrel.
That's conceivably true. We didn't have any testimony on that, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think there are other things that they could do, conditionally license or do something else other than just renew, and all we have in the record is evidence of a renewal. And it was the same for some of the other plants.
You know, you could say, well, they could go ahead and renew, because if he doesn't straighten up and fly right, he'll go to jail. So they've got a system in which there's some penalty for if they do go ahead and renew, because they, in effect, have no choice.
And I understand that point. I think when you combine the history with other evidence about the difficulty of meeting these permits and expert testimony about these facilities performing better than the EPA's own studies, then you've got reasonable doubt. And I think for my initial time. I'm finished.
Will you save some time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
This year.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I will start where he began, and that is with the negligence instruction. The courts consistently, in Hanasek and in Ortiz, both stated that they look to the statute first for the statutory, for construction of what the statute means, and in the presence of the word negligence, unmodified in any way, they would interpret it as ordinary negligence. The Fifth Circuit likewise did that with O'Keefe, and the additional wording at the after the word negligence in O'Keefe did not change it. In O'Keefe, it was a felony offense, not a misdemeanor offense, in which the court applied ordinary negligence. The Clean Water Act is a detailed statute, and it gives defendant permits, and these permits contain specific requirements. In some, one part of the statute, as mentioned in the brief, the Clean Water Act requires a showing of gross negligence. And in this particular one, it used the word negligence alone and unadorned.
So there are parts of the statute that, that did mention gross negligence, and the statute that was involved in this case did not mention gross negligence, only negligence?
That is correct. It's cited in the brief. It is... I don't recall the specific section, but there is a section that does use the term gross negligence. And I believe that was what Hanasek relied on, the fact that it was present in one part of the statute and not in another.
You see no impediment to the fact that, as I understand it, gross negligence is used for civil penalties, whereas the negligence is used in criminal.
I believe it's a different type of civil penalty, and it involves extremely hazardous materials as opposed to this. This is just any pollutant that is involved here. I would simply say that Congress said what it meant and meant what it said. With respect to the other side of his argument, that the jury should have been given an opportunity to have a correct instruction on the negligence issue. This was a responsive verdict that the jury came back with on the Pine Bayou offense. He was charged with knowing violation. The instruction given to the jury was that they were to look at the charges as they were presented, and only if they found that there was not a knowing violation were they to then go to the responsive verdict. So defendants request that somehow the instruction on negligence influenced the jury in some way. The jury was required to find knowing and all of the essential elements to the offense first before even looking at a responsive verdict. And in this case, they found the six record violations, knowing absolutely that there was proof, and they also found the Love Estates discharge violation as a felony. They obviously did not find a knowing violation at Pine Bayou, then turned to the responsive verdict, and it makes little difference whether it was a correct or an incorrect responsive verdict or definition of negligence, because the jury found knowing, and that's all that they needed to find was beyond a reasonable doubt that there was knowing. And they were correctly instructed on that, and we have to presume that the jury did follow their instructions. With respect to the effluent discharges that he mentions, and his expert's testimony was really somewhat unclear. It's not clear what he was referring to and how he came up with the numbers that he came up with. However, in rebuttal, the government presented the testimony of Stevenson, and she went through what she called the absolute numbers. And it's in Government Exhibit 175. I believe it's pages 4 and 5, address Love Estates. And you just have to look through that exhibit, it's two pages only, and see the extent of the effluent discharge violations in the that are reported from the lab results. And those were extensive, and there were over 30 of those, or at least 30 of those. And Judge King, your comment as to the, with respect to the permits, you, it makes sense. The DEQ has no one else coming forward to operate these.
I mean,
and so the DEQ has worked with him for a number of years to try to get compliance. And if you'll notice the unannounced inspections that began in 2007, in late 2007, there was one in November, one in December, and then there was one the following summer. And those were an effort to let him know these are problems that we see, and each one of the inspectors who testified, and there were a good number of them from both the EPA and from the DEQ, and they testified to meeting with defendant and explaining to him the importance of the records, the importance of maintaining his records and having them available to them so that they could assist him in operating these plants, but they were not available. Also, they made specific recommendations with regard to the cracked facilities, the holding ponds, the aeration basin. They noted all of these things to him. Many of them are not noted in the reports, but the reports that they filed do note a number of violations of his permit and number of failures to operate and properly maintain the facilities.
Can I ask you something?
Yes, ma'am.
This breach of a position of private trust, you know, the sentencing enhancement, what's the theory? The theory of that is because he's the owner of these corporations that that's a position of private trust?
The theory is that he was granted permits by the state to operate these, and he violated the trust with the state. That was the violation of it's a violation of a public trust is what the judge found. He may have said private, but I believe it's a public trust. It was his reference at sentencing. And he explains that in his sentencing, the ruling on the sentencing objections, the district judge explains in some detail exactly what he found. But he found specifically that he found specifically that the defendant was granted the permits, that these were for the benefit of his customers and really for the users of the waterways. And that he had, in committing these offenses, he had violated that trust. And we cited two other cases in which this particular provision has been used in Clean Water Act cases.
Okay. Thank you.
No further questions?
No.
I yield the balance of my time.
Mr. Stroud?
Your Honor, on the breach of trust issue that was just referenced and the sentencing factor, Ms. Cassio is correct. The apparent reason that was imposed was because Mr. Pruitt or his company had permit from the state. The problem with that, as noted, it,
you don't dispute that on appeal, do
you? We challenge the enhancement on appeal.
I understand, but the two prongs. One, it's got to be a position of trust, and then you have to find the requisite violation. But I understood that you did not challenge the fact that he, and I thought it was a position of private trust.
I thought so, too.
Right. That he I thought you conceded he held a position of private trust.
Essentially, yes. Our issue was with whether he engaged in the conduct that would trigger the enhancement.
Right.
And the reason why we don't think he did is that if you look at the first way of calculating the guideline range for this statute, before you get to any enhancements, if you just get the offense level for this statute, he got as noted on page 5 of the government's brief, there's a 4-level enhancement for offenses involving discharge without a permit, or in this case it would have been in violation of a permit. Now, the trial judge knocked off one of those levels, but my point is, just the act of violating the permit is punished as part of the calculation of the sentence for the base offense. So the enhancement ought to involve something more. And as we argued in our brief, is that if you look at the cases the government cited, the manipulation, you have to, it's not just a status enhancement. He had a permit, therefore he's responsible and holds this position of trust. It's some type of extra conduct in the cases they cited involved people who deliberately falsified records and that type of offense, and there wasn't anything like that in this case. So that's our basic argument as to why the enhancement shouldn't apply, because, you know, the underlying calculation of the sentence for the conduct covers permit status, and there was no showing that he went beyond that, because if to hold otherwise, it really wouldn't be an enhancement. It would be automatic upon permit status. The O'Keefe case.
Before you get to O'Keefe, I wanted to ask you, kind of hang out and quite ask you on your opening, this is my question. The juror being placed on alternate, when the man called in, the woman, the juror called in and said, I live 51 miles away, my car's broken down, and the judge apparently said, well, I'll send a marshal to get you, and I understood Pruitt's counsel, I don't know if you were at the trial, objected to that being, quote, heavy-handed, close quote. Was the judge offered any other suggested way of getting this juror to the trial?
Ultimately, no. You're correct. When it first came up, and I was co-counsel at trial, so I was there when it first came up, our reaction to that was that it would be, there was a concern that it would be heavy-handed. After the juror was talked to on the phone, we did come back and say on the record that we thought he should not be excused, that it would not be heavy-handed, that it was so far into the trial, because this was, I don't remember the exact day, but it was not at the beginning. We were well into the trial, and so that objection was made. And I understand the government's argument is that traditionally, with respect to replacement of jurors, you have to show prejudice. I can't show, because I don't know what happened in the jury, what would have happened in the jury deliberation room if the juror had not been replaced. That surely can't be the standard. I know the court has said we need prejudice, but I would think if we show that the juror was selected and seated, and there wasn't within the, if the trial court abused its discretion by excusing that juror when he could have been kept on, that would be the prejudice, that the defendant would be denied the jury as originally selected and impaneled.
How much more was left in the trial? How many more days after that did it continue?
That's in my brief, and I'm going from I'd have to go from memory, yeah, not certain, but I want to say that we were still on the government side of the case, but nearing the end of that. It was a two-week trial, and I want to say that it was in the second week, but I put the specific date, I think, fifth day. Okay, so right in the middle. And pushing a point where we were about, I think, to start the defense side of the case. I'm out of time. I appreciate Your Honor's attention.
Thank you.